Chapter 48 Manic Messiahs. The man with the enormous, tangled beard raised his arm above his head and cried in a deep voice, "Bring a curse, O God, on San Francisco, on Portland, on Corvallis and on Seattle!" With which he turned and clambered on board the train from Seattle. It was the morning of April the 17th, 1906. The next day, when he arrived at his destination, Newport, Oregon, his followers met him with the incredible news San Francisco had just been torn apart by an earthquake and was now burning to the ground. "Yes, I knew God would respond," said the prophet quietly. The man's name was Franz Edmund Krefeld. He spoke with a German accent, and in the year 1906 he was 31 years old. He enters the history of false prophets and cranky messiahs in 1903, shortly after he had been thrown out of a Salvation Army group in Corvallis, Oregon. According to the historian Arnold Toynbee, all major prophets follow a cycle of withdrawal and return, retreating from society to the solitude of forest or desert, and then returning with the great message finally crystallised. Franz Krefeld was no exception. Early in 1903, he vanished into the forests of Oregon. When he emerged a few months later, he had grown a beard like a briar patch full of birds' nests, and his hair fell over his shoulders. He had also acquired a new name, Joshua the Second. Like another prophet who was making a reputation at the time, Grigory Efimovich Rasputin, the Russian monk, Franz Krefeld held a remarkable fascination for women. There the resemblance seems to end. Rasputin undoubtedly had genuine powers of thaumaturgy, or spiritual healing, and his diaries reveal that his mystical faith was deep and genuine. Krefeld, on the other hand, was a born deceiver. The best that can be said for him is that he was also self-deceived. He preached his mission in Corvallis and acquired a few dozen followers, male and female. For some reason, the males dropped out. It was their wives and daughters who remained. Joshua's religious faith became more fervent and compelling. Surrounded by adoring women, he would call upon full spirit to descend on them. They would all sway and chant, clapping rhythmically as the excitement became hysterical. Joshua would cry, "Begone, vile clothes!" and start to fling his robes around the room. The women would do the same, some of them modestly stripping down to their shifts, others flinging off every stitch. And then they would all roll on the floor, moaning and crying out. Inevitably, the men of Corvallis began to feel uneasy, and some of the more respectable wives left. Joshua had announced that he was seeking for a woman who would become the second mother of Christ. He, of course, was to be the father. He searched conscientiously. Many candidates were rigorously tested, and if the Holy Spirit finally indicated that none was suitable, they at least had the satisfaction of knowing that they had been engaged in the Lord's work. This quest for the second mother took place on Kiger Island in the middle of a river, and throughout the summer the prophet and his followers held prayer meetings by night and danced naked in the woods by day. When the winter came, Joshua moved back into Corvallis and into the home of a man named O.P. Hunt, whose daughter, Maud, was one of the prophet's warmest admirers. A notice over the door said, "No admittance except on God's business." The prayer meetings finally aroused so much hostility that Joshua was summoned to the courthouse, together with his chief male disciple, Brother Brooks, for a sanity hearing. He was found sane, but advised to leave the town. He ignored the suggestion and went back to the Hunt's house. And then someone began to circulate photographs that had been taken on Kiger Island. They showed naked women, most of them recognisable as Corvallis housewives, romping in the bushes. On January the 4th, 1904, a deputation of male citizens called on the prophet, escorted him to the edge of town, tarred and feathered him, and turned him loose. He was found by Mrs. Hunt and her daughter Maud and brought back home. Shortly afterwards, he married Maud. But he soon felt the old compulsion to continue the Lord's work, and he went to Portland to visit one of his chief female disciples. One day, the lady's husband found the prophet performing the Lord's work with his trousers on. He took out a warrant for adultery. Joshua's angry father-in-law offered $150 for his capture, but Joshua could not be found. 3 months later, a child ran under the Hunt's house, which was built clear of the ground, looking for a lost ball. He saw a bearded man dressed in a blanket, and ran out yelling. The police were called and Joshua was dragged out. It seemed that he had been living under the house since he fled from Portland, supplied with food by his wife and her mother. In court, he admitted adultery with the Portland disciple, but explained that he could not be judged by secular law. After all, Jesus had often broken the Sabbath. He was sentenced to 2 years in jail, but was released after 15 months. His ex-wife, Maud, now divorced, was living in Seattle with her brother Frank and sister-in-law. Joshua wrote to her, asking her to remarry him. She agreed, and they were joined again in Seattle. The brother and sister-in-law were deeply impressed by the prophet. So much so that when Joshua ordered them to sell their home and their worldly goods and to move in with him to a Garden of Eden near Newport in Oregon, they did so without hesitation. It was as he left Seattle that Joshua pronounced the curse that caused the San Francisco earthquake. Once established in his Eden, facing the Pacific Ocean just south of Waldport, the prophet sent word to former disciples at Corvallis, including a pretty girl named Esther Mitchell. Without hesitation, half the female population of Corvallis left home and streamed towards Eden. One husband rushed after his wife, pausing only to buy a revolver and some cartridges. As he reached the ferry boat across the Aquinnah Bay, he saw the prophet standing on deck surrounded by disciples. He pointed the revolver and pulled the trigger 5 times. Nothing happened. And when the outraged husband examined the pistol, he discovered that the shop had sold him rimfire cartridges for a centerfire gun. But the female disciples were not surprised. They knew that Joshua was immortal. All the same, the prophet could see that he was courting danger if he remained in Eden during the next week or so. The sensible course would be to allow the husbands to simmer down. As they converged on Eden, Joshua and Maud disappeared. George Mitchell, brother of the prophet's favourite disciple Esther, reasoned that they would be making probably for Seattle again. He tracked them down there on May the 7th, 1906. At 8 o'clock that morning, Joshua was looking in the window of Quick's drugstore in First Avenue while Maud was weighing herself on a machine. George Mitchell stepped up to the prophet, placed a gun against his ear and pulled the trigger. Joshua collapsed without even turning his head. Maud flew at Mitchell, screaming. When a policeman came running up, she told him, "That's my husband, Joshua. He will rise in 3 days." But Joshua stayed dead, and Mitchell was tried for his murder. The defence argued that Joshua was a degenerate of the worst sort. The jury agreed, particularly when Mitchell stated in court that Joshua had taken the virginity of both his sisters. George Mitchell was acquitted. His sister Esther listened impassively. On July the 12th, 1906, George Mitchell stood at King Street Station, waiting to take the train home. His brother, Fred, saw Esther standing nearby and asked her to come and speak to George. Esther walked over to the rest of the group, and as they moved towards the ticket barrier, she drew a small revolver from under the folded coat on her arm. She placed it against George's ear and pulled the trigger, and, like Joshua, he collapsed without a word. Esther Mitchell and Maud Crefield were both held. They admitted planning George's murder together. Maud took strychnine in prison. Esther was tried but found not guilty by reason of insanity, and she was committed to the Washington State Asylum. 3 years later, she was released, looking very thin and ill, and died at the home of friends shortly afterwards. She was aged just 20. The false prophet is not, of course, a modern phenomenon. However, Franz Crefield is an interesting example of a typical modern variety. Writers on religious experience concede that it's difficult to draw a line between the genuine and the false prophet. When any human being starts to feel stifled and bored with the quality of everyday experience, he's already experiencing the basic religious urge, the craving for more vitality and a higher quality of life. It expresses itself as a feeling of irritation and contempt for the repetitious dullness that most people accept as everyday life. All religions have one thing in common, the belief that man was meant for higher things than repetition. Joshua II was possessed by this urge as indisputably as his biblical ancestor who destroyed the walls of Jericho. As to the overdeveloped sexual urge that caused so much alarm and envy among the husbands of Corvallis, it must also be admitted that this often coexists alongside powerful religious urges. A prophet is, by definition, a person of high dominance. And as Abraham Maslow's researches showed, high dominance is almost invariably accompanied by a strong libido. Maslow's psychology also suggests the simple way of distinguishing between genuine and false prophets. When a human undergoes genuine psychological development, he or she moves upwards through various levels of need or desire. The need for security, the need for sex and love, the need for self-esteem and for the respect of one's fellow citizens, and then finally the need for creative self-expression, for self-actualization. Only this level, Maslow would say, is the genuine religious level. A truly religious person is driven by higher needs than the craving for sex or admiration, although this is obviously not to say that he must be totally devoid of the need for them. They must continue to exist, but they are no longer his basic urges. When we consider an evangelist like Amy Semple McPherson, the question of priorities is altogether more difficult. A pretty girl, often referred to as the world's most pulchritudinous evangelist, Amy was the 1920s equivalent of Billy Graham. Her first husband, a missionary, died in China. Her second divorced her with the interesting comment that she was a dual personality, overflowing with universal love in the revival tent, but a wildcat in the home. After a slow start on the East Coast, she achieved fame as a preacher in San Diego, California in 1921. San Diego is America's suicide centre. When Amy asked the sick and the lame to mount the platform, and many of them walked away cured, she achieved overnight fame. She opened an Angelus Temple in Los Angeles in 1923, and her technique was basically Billy Graham's. Flowers, music, golden trumpets, red robes, angels. A delightful spectacle conducted with superb showmanship, with an appeal for candidates for instant salvation. In 1925, Amy met a radio announcer, Kenneth Ormiston. Their intimacy became a subject of gossip and scandal. On May the 18th, 1926, she drove to a beach at Venice, Los Angeles, and disappeared. For more than a month, ships and aircraft searched for her body. Whispers of her affair with Ormiston reached the newspapers, and it was rumoured that she had not drowned, only fled to some remote love nest. Ormiston had also vanished. In June 1926, Amy reappeared, knocking on a door in Agua Prieta in New Mexico and explaining that she had been kidnapped by two men and a woman. Then reporters began digging, and it became clear that Amy had spent the past month dodging around the western United States with her lover, Ormiston. On September the 17th, she was charged with conspiracy to obstruct justice. And finally, the case was dismissed. Rumour has it that the public prosecutor accepted $30,000 to drop it. He was afterwards sentenced to jail for corrupt conduct in office. But Amy's career as an evangelist was over. A nationwide tour was a flop. She died in 1944, and it looked very much like suicide. On the continent of Europe, there is a tendency to dismiss these excesses as typically American. But in fact, Europe has been as subject to them as any continent. In 17th century England, Lodowick Muggleton was the founder of a secret sect known as the Muggletonians, who preached that God had a human body. A century later, a preacher named Edward Irving called upon the Lord for a miracle. His followers began to speak in strange foreign languages, and spirits informed them that miracles would occur at the end of 40 days. When nothing happened, the sect gradually dissolved. At about the same time, a prophetess named Joanna Southcott gathered thousands of followers when she announced that the new Redeemer would be a woman and that, predictably, it was herself. In 1814, at the age of 64, she explained that she was about to give birth to Shiloh, the Prince of Peace. When the pregnancy was revealed to be purely hysterical, her followers deserted in droves, and Joanna died in the same year. Joanna Southcott's box was supposed to contain writings and other sacred relics that would save the world and bring the millennium. However, when it was secretly opened in 1927, it was found to contain only a lottery ticket and a woman's nightcap. One of the most remarkable of the preachers of the Spirit of Love was the Reverend Henry James Prince, who became curate of Charlinch near Bridgewater in Somerset in the 19th century, and was soon drawing enormous crowds with his fiery sermons. He was permanently surrounded by adoring female disciples, and when ugly rumours reached his bishop, he was forbidden to continue preaching. He left the Church of England and began preaching in barns and open fields. One day he announced he was the prophet Elijah, and his followers accepted the revelation without question. Prince moved to Brighton, then a fashionable resort, and became the most popular preacher of his day. With £30,000 collected from his disciples, he bought an estate at Spaxton near Bridgewater and turned it into Agapomene, or the Abode of Love. Disciples who wished to join him had to sell all that they had and to contribute it to the community. About 60 followers, mostly women, accepted the invitation. Unlike his American contemporary, John Humphrey Noyes, Prince did not actually preach free love, but he certainly practiced it, regarding his female disciples as brides of the Lord. He himself didn't mind being addressed as God, and letters addressed to Our Lord God, Somerset, reached him without difficulty. One day he summoned all his disciples to the billiard room to watch a public act of worship, his intimate union with a Miss Patterson on the settee. When she became pregnant, Prince told his followers that there would be no birth, just as there was no death, and when a baby arrived he had to explain it away as a final despairing act of the devil. Then lawsuits began to cloud the horizon. In 1860, three female followers sued for the return of nearly £6,000, and the revelation of the goings-on in the Abode of Love startled and shocked Victorian England. After the case, Prince's actions became more discreet. However, he continued to live happily, surrounded by his private harem, until his death, aged 88, in 1899. 2 years before his death, Prince had acquired an influential disciple, Hugh Smith Pigott, another spellbinding preacher. Smith Pigott took over the Agapomenite church at Clapton, a suburb of London, and his sermons were soon producing the same effect as Prince's had done half a century before. On Sunday, September the 7th, 1902, Smith Pigott announced from the pulpit that he had become divine and that he would shortly walk on water. The next Sunday, 6,000 people waited for his arrival, cheering and booing. Showers of stones followed him back home. Smith Pigott decided to move to the Abode of Love, and in 1904 he took up residence, together with his wife and a mistress, who soon bore him a child. When in 1909 a bishop's court found him guilty of immorality, uncleanness and wickedness of life, he commented, "Doesn't matter what they do, I'm God." And in the following year a daughter was born to him by another disciple. He went on preaching and gathering more disciples in America and in Scandinavia. And when he found particularly attractive girls, they were dubbed soul brides and sent back to Spaxton to await his arrival. Smith Pigott died in 1927, disappointing the expectations of his followers, who were convinced that he was immortal. One woman, who had been brought up at the Abode of Love, revealed that when the Reverend Prince had died, he had handed Smith Pigott a horn of power and authority to carry on his mission. The exact nature of this horn of power is not known, but the symbolism seems apt. In 1911, precisely one century after the birth of the Reverend Prince, another Messiah, Francis Penchevich, was born in America. Up to the time of the Second World War, he had a curious and chequered career as a boilermaker, a shipyard worker and dishwasher, and had served jail sentences for burglary, larceny, passing dud checks, not supporting his wife, and sending a threatening letter to Roosevelt. It was during the war, when he was a conscientious objector, that he organised a cult called the Fountain of the World, followed by the initials WKFL, standing for Wisdom, Knowledge, Faith and Love. When he came out of the army, he changed his name to Krishna Venter, adopted flowing oriental robes, and explained that he had been born in a valley in Nepal. He had visited Rome as long ago as AD 600, although on a more recent visit the Pope's guards had turned him away and he had been teleported to America in 1932. The cult, with 100 or so members, settled in Ventura County, California, near Box Canyon. According to Krishna Venter, America would be shaken by a communist revolution in 1965, and in 1975 he and his 144,000 followers would take over the country. On December the 9th, 1958, two disgruntled ex-followers, Ralph Miller and Peter Kamenoff, called on Krishna Venter in his San Fernando Valley retreat and demanded that he confess that his own messianism was basically a cloak for sexual promiscuity, their own wives having been among the messiah's brides. When Krishna declined to confess, one of the men opened a canvas bag and a tremendous explosion blew the monastery apart, killing a dozen people and injuring many more. In a pickup truck nearby, the police found a tape recording made by the two Avengers, listing the prophet's misdemeanours and declaring, "He isn't Christ, he's only a man." The words could serve as the epitaph of manic messiahs in general.